From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Voting early is easy. Getting the votes counted early is harder.
What I'm interested in is how do we protect the integrity, but then help the clerks be more efficient.
Today, Michigan gets ready for a surge of early voting. Also on the show, a much-loved city administrator in Lansing stands accused of misconduct. Joan Jackson Johnson has a long reputation as a fierce advocate for the homeless. An audit raises questions about how contracts were awarded under her leadership. Also, a living legend in Michigan sports talks to us about gender inequality in coaching.
I've seen a Hall of Fame softball coach who had over 900 career wins who lost her job and couldn't even get a job interview elsewhere.
Coach Carol Hutchins and much more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, the coach who turned the University of Michigan into a softball powerhouse talks about the yawning equity gap in sports coaching. But first, absentee ballots are now available for one of the most anticipated elections in recent memory. In addition to the many state, county, and local issues in 2020, the top of the ticket in November is sure to draw maximum attention. Michigan's county clerks are expressing concerns, though, about how the tabulation of early votes will play out across hundreds of local jurisdictions and cities and townships and counties all over Michigan. Does it all have to happen on election night? Justin Roebuck is the Ottawa County Clerk. Justin, welcome to Stateside.
Good to be with you.
What concerns do you have about how this is going to play out if there are potentially hundreds or maybe even thousands more ballots to count before the sun's even up on election day?
I think Proposal 3 in 2018 really did provide our voters with much greater access and better opportunities, particularly with no reason absentee voting. But we as a clerk community have to be prepared for that influx. And I do think that our community is doing a fantastic job of getting ready. It boils down to a number of different factors. You know, one is training our workers and preparing for that influx in volume. Absentee ballots, fortunately, are something that we can see coming down the road, right? Because we know how many requests we're getting in the days and weeks prior to an election. And we can adjust a little bit to say that we need additional staffing, or, you know, we need to kind of set up an absentee precinct a little bit differently in terms of how the workers function. But the other thing that we really do need from the legislature are, you know, some additional tools that will help. I've been a big advocate, along with a number of my colleagues around the state, for processing absentee ballots earlier than Election Day. A number of states do this now.
In layperson's terms, does processing mean tabulation or the diligence that needed with ballots that look different?
So when we say processing absentee ballots early, can vary in terms of what level we're doing. For example, Senator Ruth Johnson has some proposed legislation coming down the pike that would allow larger jurisdictions to verify the voter information that's on the outer envelope of an absentee ballot, open that envelope, verify that the ballot number is the correct ballot, and then save and hold on to that ballot until election day, and then run it through a tabulation device. So that's kind of a middle-of-the-road approach. We're still getting some of that processing out of the way that right now actually occurs on election day. And that would give a leg up to a number of our larger jurisdiction clerks across the state. So I think that's one option. Another option is simply doing all those functions and casting the ballot in the tabulator, but not generating the totals until after the polls close on election day.
Is it more time consuming to tabulate votes or to process them?
Again, it can vary depending on the type of equipment that's being used, but typically we see the greater volume of time is being spent processing the ballots. And that's everything, including, you know, receiving the envelopes, double checking the numbers to make sure the number of envelopes you have matches the number of voters who, you know, are on your poll list. And then actually, you know, looking at the ballot number that's on the outside of the envelope, making sure that that ballot number matches the ballot in the envelope. And then we actually have to remove the numbered stub for the privacy of the voter so that we don't know which ballot that was attached to as it gets tabulated. And then the simple mechanics, right, of removing the ballot from the envelope, flattening it out a little bit so that it goes through the tabulator in a smooth fashion. So those, you know, mechanical functions actually do take a significant amount of time.
As you mentioned, State Senator Ruth Johnson has made a proposal to give county clerks and local agencies of elections a few more tools, a little bit more flexibility to deal with early processing or possibly early tabulation. Does that bill do what you need it to do?
You know, I think that bill is a great step in the right direction of giving clerks tools in the toolkit for helping handle the volume of absentee ballots that we're going to encounter. You know, the current version of the bill does cap the ability of a jurisdiction to do that at population of 40,000 or greater. I do think rather than looking at the population, maybe we should take a look at the number of absentee ballots that are actually processed. You know, we have some jurisdictions that are smaller than that, that may be processing a number of absentee ballots where this early processing legislation would really help them as well. Representative Julie Calley, who chairs the House Elections Committee, has also introduced legislation that would allow local clerks to contract with other local clerks and with the county to process their absentee ballots. So that legislation is a little bit different, but actually gives local clerks another option. For example, we have some small jurisdictions here in Ottawa County that are currently processing their absentee ballots in the precinct. Say we're able to contract with the county to process those ballots, that would significantly reduce the burden on the local clerk and on the precinct workers themselves. We would be able to process efficiently and in a timely manner have those election results out, certainly be a fraction of the cost. And that option may work better for a smaller jurisdiction than this early processing option. But we do just need a few more tools in the toolkit for our local election administrators to be able to handle the volume.
Justin Roebuck is the Ottawa County Clerk. Justin, thanks for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
State Senator Ruth Johnson, who you might recall, served for two terms as Michigan's Secretary of State, has introduced new bills in the Senate Local Government and Elections Committee to address some of the needs that we just heard about. The committee is going to be taking testimony on these bills tomorrow. Senator Ruth Johnson, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, we just heard that it may not be enough to let voters cast their ballots early, but if clerks can't count the ballots early, we still risk log jams come election day. Your bill suggests some changes for the absentee voter counting boards, the bodies that do this tabulation. When should their work start?
The ballots should not be counted until election day if you're to protect the integrity of the elections. But the bill would allow some pre-processing and also to bring in staff as shifts so no one would have to be there for any extended period that's unreasonable. We have 1,625 local clerks. We're different than most states. They'd have their elections countywide, and you can't really compare it because we're decentralized, and we have a law that you can't have more than 2,999 people per precinct to try to keep the line shorter in Michigan. But what I'm interested in is how do we protect the integrity, but then help the clerks be more efficient? And so the two bills, one, it would allow the clerk in a city or township with a population of more than 40,000 to shift the workers in an absentee counting board at any time after the polls are closed. Right now, those poll workers, those 30,000 people, have to give up their cell phones and they have to stay in the room. We're saying that after the election's over, so no one can leak any counts, that they may be relieved if that's what the clerk wants to do and bring in fresh workers because there will be more people and there has been a huge trend in more people voting absentee. And under this bill, there would be no gaps between shifts, so the ballots could never be left unattended, and at a minimum, one election inspector from each major political party has to be present at all times. So
you're suggesting, I'm sorry to jump in here, we just have 5 minutes.
Sure.
Though you're suggesting doing this in any city or township with more than 40,000 voters. Why not make it true across the board?
You know, we have a township in the UP that has 7 people that live in that township. It's not practical. And you have to have a Democrat and a Republican there. And so we're looking at high populations. That's where they're going to have the log jam if we don't give the clerks some tools. The number is still being discussed in the bill, and I'm willing to look at other numbers. And that's Senate Bill 756. And then I have Senate Bill 757, and that's the absentee ballot pre-processing. So it would allow a clerk in a city or a township, again, with 40,000 people or more, to perform certain pre-processing of absentee ballots on Monday prior to the election from 9 to 5. So again, it would allow for challengers from both parties to be present during this work, and they would be allowed to remove the absentee ballots from the first envelope, but not the second. The ballot can never be exposed because that's when it can be changed. And we've had several cases of that, one on a very large scale and one on a smaller scale. So you don't want the ballots exposed, because if they are, they are at much more risk. So as part of the pre-processing, it would require them to secure the ballots in that inside envelope. And that is then kept in a room that is locked down, that's very secure.
We're closing in on the end of January here. If your legislation passes, are you confident the clerks could put it into place by March?
The clerks have asked for some help. It's based on my experience from my boots on the ground. I've been the Oakland County Clerk Register of Deeds, and that's the second largest county, and as Secretary of State, I certainly know that the clerks need some tools that make it more efficient for them. And I do believe that if the clerks in these larger communities want these tools, they'll be available for them.
So it sounds like it's unclear whether they would fully be able to enact all this. If everything is not changed by the time of the March primary, what will you be watching for?
Well, of course, the March primary, there'll be a large turnout, but where we have by far the largest turnout is when you have a presidential. So we're always looking for ways that we can help give the clerks tools, as long as it doesn't impact the integrity. So we'll still be watching for ideas that are coming forward. And these ideas are generated out of a number of meetings with clerks, and I think they'll help.
Senator Johnson, thank you so much for your time today.
You're so welcome. Thank you. It's good to get the word out, and also I would recommend if anybody supports these bills that they let their legislator know so that we can move as rapidly as possible.
Ruth Johnson represents Michigan's Senate District 14. She is also a former Michigan Secretary of State. Coming up, Coach Carol Hutchins discusses her recent New York Times editorial about lack of female leadership in college sports.
There's virtually no women of presence on any benches of any male sports in the NCAA.
That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. Last month, three more elk were found shot dead in the Pigeon River State Forest near Gaylord. This was the latest in a series of poaching incidents that made the past couple of months some of the worst for Michigan's elk herd. Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Wanshura reports the killings have many area residents confused and outraged.
It's a sunny winter afternoon deep in the Pigeon River State Forest. Michigan Department of Natural Resources Officer Matt Thunick hikes his way to the spot where three cow elk were recently poached.
So this is the site of the first animal. It was laying here on the ground. So
you can still see pinkish-red snow where blood pooled after the elk was shot. Thunick says the other two elk were found about 50 and 100 yards away from this first one.
I've had lots of people from the public say, why would somebody do that? And I said, I don't know. I'm hoping to find out when we eventually catch these people.
Over the past 3 months, 8 elk have been poached in northern Michigan. But the DNR says the real number of poaching cases is likely 2 to 3 times higher than what's known. That's because the elk habitat is so large, only so many of the poachings are ever discovered. Now, in 3 of the poaching cases, hunters shot the animals on accident and turned themselves in. But in the other 5 cases, the elk were shot and just left to rot. Usually, by the time the DNR gets to them, it's too late to salvage any of the meat.
It's just a pure waste of an animal.
Sarah Doan serves local hunters at the Elkhorn Grill and Tavern in Vanderbilt. She says most of the people she talks to are disgusted with the poachings.
It's not a trophy. Nobody's being fed. It's not something that can be donated to a food pantry or anything after the fact. People are very upset about it.
Michigan has a long history with elk. Before the state was established, a species of eastern elk roamed the land. As Europeans came, those elk were overhunted and eventually wiped out. But in 1918, elk were reintroduced to the state from Yellowstone National Park. Three separate herds were released in northern Michigan, and two of those herds again were wiped out. But the last one, a herd south of Wolverine in the Pigeon River country, survived and are the reason Michigan has elk today. Brian Mastenbrook is with the DNR. He says the reason that herd survived while the others didn't was because the community around the Pigeon River country really took pride in the animals.
The predators were non-existent except for humans. The people must have just protected them more.
That support continues. Today, Michigan has around 1,200 elk. Ryan Lucas is a hunter who's shopping at Jay's Sporting Goods in Gaylord.
We take a lot of pride and care in our elk herd here. We're the only place in Michigan that has it, and it's something that's special to us. So we do kind of protect it and appreciate it.
So why the unusually high number of elk poachings this year? Meredith Gore is a conservation social scientist at Michigan State University. She says the answer is complicated.
It's possible that people might be doing this for the thrill, or because they're bored, or because they're trying to do some sort of gamesmanship.
Another thing Gore looks at is whether there have been any related policy or regulatory changes, like the controversial deer and elk baiting ban enacted last year. Then last month, when state lawmakers passed legislation to reverse the ban, Governor Gretchen Whitmer vetoed it. Meredith Gore says it's all something to keep in mind.
Sometimes people retaliate as a form of rebellion. It's almost like a form of civil disobedience, if you will.
That's the theory Jim Ormsby is going with. He's an elk hunting guide from Vanderbilt. He thinks people are frustrated and trying to send a message to the state.
And I think this is just kind of a little repercussion to say, hey, you know what I mean? You ain't going to let us bait. You ain't going to let us, you know, feed the deer and blah, blah. I think this is a message saying, hey, you know what I mean?
3102.
I'll be back in the truck. I'll have a reporter with me.
Mark DePew is a sergeant with the DNR in Gaylord. He says whatever the motivation is for poaching, it doesn't really matter.
They're stealing from everybody in this state. Those animals belong to us, and we need to take care of them.
DePew says because everybody is talking about these poachings, and a $1,000 reward was recently offered, he's pretty confident they'll catch whoever did this.
People usually just can't keep this quiet. They're going to tell somebody, you know, whether it's one day, you know, 2 years from now, they get intoxicated and they start to, somebody hears something.
Anyone with information on the elk poachings can call the Michigan DNR. Penalties for poaching include at least $5,000 per elk and up to 180 days in jail. For Stateside, I'm Dan Wanshura.
That story was featured on Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. There's no particular reason why a college softball team should become an NCAA powerhouse, but in more than three decades, Coach Carol Hutchins has built an empire. She's the winningest coach in Michigan history, across sports, men and women's, with more than 1,500 victories. But she'd like some company. She wrote a recent op-ed for the New York Times noting that few coaches in women's sports are, in fact, women, which wouldn't be so strange, except that women coaches are extremely rare among men's sports. Coach Hutchins, welcome to Stateside.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your op-ed in the New York Times noted that of all coaches for all women's sports, that 42% are women, which is astonishing. But I was even more flabbergasted to read what you said about how before Title IX, there were far, far more women coaching, 90%. What happened?
Well, I think you can look at the fact that back in the late 60s and throughout the 70s, you can look at college athletics, you can look at high school athletics. Women played largely on club teams, while young men had varsity teams, they had junior varsity teams at all levels. There wasn't a lot of organized sport for women.
It was a labor of love.
It was definitely a labor of love. But there were certainly a number of young women, myself being one of them. And back in the 60s, we were called tomboys. You know, we like to do what boys like to do. And most of us were told, well, that's, you know, girls don't play sports. Boys play sports. Girls cheerlead. And we were also told, in general, girls aren't interested, which wasn't true because I knew a lot of girls that were interested. But it was hard to be interested in something that didn't exist. And I talk about my story a lot because my evolution as a person, I was born in the late 50s, Title IX passed when I was a sophomore in high school. I just kind of evolved with Title IX my whole career. And I did not play a varsity sport in high school until my senior year when the MHSAA finally added girls basketball as a state-sanctioned sport, and we had a state tournament. We had actually a real schedule. We had real uniforms. We had a bus that took us, and we even had cheerleaders. Before that, we had played basically, they called it GAA, Girls Athletic Activities, or just basically club basketball. We'd play four or five games a year, and our gym teachers would take us on, and those who had interest in different sports would coach us. And so I played a few of those sports in high school, but it wasn't until my senior year I really had a varsity status. And the same was true in college. And so largely, even though those few opportunities, you would see women as the coaches, women who had an interest in sport, women who had had their own active time in their day. And my varsity coach in college, Karen Langland, was a full-time instructor in the School of Physical Education, as she had full-time teaching duties, and she was a part-time basketball coach for probably, if I'm not mistaken, $6,000 a year. And Judd Heathcote was the basketball coach at Michigan State, and he was, of course, a full-time coach paid probably six figures back in that day, and Karen was just considered part-time. And it was like throw a few crumbs out to the women, and they would get to play. So you can look at there were fewer opportunities out there to coach, but they were largely filled with women who were interested in women having opportunities to play and recognize the value in the educational aspect of being an athlete.
After Title IX, though, there were many more salaried positions coaching women's varsity sports. It appears that a lot more men got interested in the jobs.
Well, you can say that, and it took a while. It didn't happen. Title IX passed in 72, and it was all the way through the 80s, really. I would like to see the numbers at that point of how many women coached, and there were certainly men involved. There were men in coaching, and my first college basketball coach my freshman year was a male, but this is the interesting statistic. He had come over from the men's team. He had been the men's manager, the equipment manager of the men's basketball team for Gus Kanakis and then Judd Heathcote, and they'd made him into the women's basketball coach. So that will tell you a little bit how those things came down.
So it sounds like this is a confluence of opportunities being available and a lack of a development path for women's coaches.
Well, and
coaches
a lot of people would argue where there weren't a lot of women who had a ton of a varsity experience, you know. But as it goes, back then, women were the ones who wanted to see this move forward. They wanted to see athletics progress. But as Title IX increased the opportunity for women, it mandated across the board that if you're a federally funded institution, which is the majority of colleges, not all, and of course high schools, you had to give the women the same opportunity in all aspects of education, not just sport, but all aspects of education, the same opportunity as the men got. And it really became glaring where the biggest inequity was, which was in sport. And so we started adding more teams, creating varsity opportunities for the women. And along the way, in the college level, the NCAA decided to sponsor women's sports, and that was in 1982. And when they started sponsoring the championships, you saw a huge spike in opportunities given and salaries for coaches and so forth. So the women athletes, you know, started getting a lot more of the opportunity. But as it became a really full-blown profession, you certainly just saw, which I think was normal. I don't think this is a case where you would ostracize men for being interested in coaching, because coaching is coaching. And I've listened to many a male coach talk about how much they love coaching women, how they're kind of a different animal to coach. But the fact is that the issue here is who's being chosen to lead, period, to lead in athletic and the leadership positions. And coaching is certainly a leadership position.
What does the career path look like right now for women players who want to be coaching?
Well, obviously, first and foremost, we look at young women who have come through the trenches of playing competitively. And it depends on what level they're aspiring to. But if they're an education major and aspire to be a high school teacher and a coach, obviously, they go into that route. The college path is basically you come up through the ranks of being a competitive player, and you would hire in. We usually start at what we call the volunteer status in softball. We have what's called the volunteer coach, and it's a glorified position where you can come in, work for free, and get experience. And you see men and women take that path and then hopefully aspire into paid positions. One of the issues that goes hand in hand in this is certainly when a woman plays competitive college softball and she is out in the job market and she is compared with all the other candidates in the market, we see a lot of programs who end up taking young men who, face it, young men never played college softball because it's not a college sport. They may have played baseball. They may be good at what they do. But my concern is that if you look across the landscape, and if you look at just college, I mean, you could certainly look at high school and look at travel ball, and those have different issues. But if you look across the landscape of college athletics, the presence of male coaches on the benches of all women's teams, especially in Division I and especially in Power Five, there's a presence. Almost all benches have, whether it's male assistant, whether it's a couple male assistants, whether it's male head coaches, the presence of men coaching women is huge. Is there anything wrong with that? No. But if you look across the exact same men's sports, across Division I, across the Power Five, there's virtually no women of presence on any benches of any male sports in the NCAA.
So what's on your mind about this? Something maybe like the Rooney Rule, which in the NFL requires teams to interview people of color when they have a coaching vacancy?
That's certainly been spoken of in our profession, in the think tanks out there. To me, the first thing, and part of the reason for my involvement in the op-ed for the New York Times is really public awareness of it. One of the things that we talked about during the interview that wasn't in the interview was, you know, we're very committed to diversity and inclusion across colleges across the country. And most college presidents would not probably be too keen on having only 25% of their entire faculty be women. If there's only 42% of women coaching women's sports and virtually 100% of men coaching male sports, you see we're really barely at 25% of the total leadership population. And it's an opportunity to lead, to have role models, and for women to have the same opportunities as men.
There was an article a couple of years ago in Champion Magazine, which is an NCAA publication. I know you're aware of it because you were quoted in it pretty extensively. And the article noted that sometimes coaching has not been a kind profession for working mothers, for gay women, and others who may have faced discrimination in hiring. How do you think people in power positions can be held to some kind of transparency about hiring decisions that might be discriminatory?
I think one of the most fascinating things I have been studying this last year is the implicit gender bias that is still alive and well, definitely in college athletics, definitely in society. I'm certainly not here to talk politics, but if you look at how the female candidates are judged, there's certainly a bias that women are held to different standards. And I think women are held to different standards in our profession, for sure. And whether it comes to the hiring practices, definitely women have different issues than men because we are largely the caregivers of our families. You know, you have women who want to create families and they have to have maternity leave. And those are things that, you know, in a hiring practice cannot be held against you. But are they? I'm certain that they could be. But I think that the bigger issue is, you know, who is making the hiring decisions? And if, again, across the landscape, I don't know the exact percentages, but male athletic directors dominate the landscape. There are very few women athletic directors, and in the Power Five, I believe there's only five.
I want to say the national percentage is only 18% female.
And that would include all the levels. So in the Division I and Power Five, it's very low percentage. And again, they say people tend to hire people who are like them. And, you know, men have their own network. But I don't think it's largely on just the men to take a look and say, gee, we need to include more women. Men don't seem to be offended by the fact that women don't have a seat at the table. I do believe if they were the population that didn't have a seat at the table, they would look at it through the same lens that perhaps I look at it through. But I think it starts with people like myself who have been fortunate to have this longstanding leadership position at a university that is one of the leaders and the best. And it's on people like myself to speak out, to ensure that I give women an opportunity, as I want to see my young women who play under me, young women who I play against, have that opportunity to go out and get a chance to do what I've done my whole life. And it's really about opportunity and opportunity for leadership positions.
That's U of M softball coach Carol Hutchins. After the break, we'll continue our conversation and talk about the double standard for women coaches and men coaches let go from their positions.
When a woman coach is fired, I have seen very, very few women resurface in the coaching profession.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Back to my conversation with Carol Hutchins, one of the most successful softball coaches in NCAA history. She recently co-authored a New York Times op-ed calling out the lack of leadership opportunities for women in college sports. Around 40% of women's college sports are coached by women, while virtually all of men's sports have male coaches. We pick up with a discussion about how hard it is for women to bounce back when they're let go from a coaching job. You talk in your op-ed about the double standard for women coaches, and you say that we all know what the trope is. When a woman doesn't lead well or gets dismissed, it's evidence that a woman can't lead. But if a man doesn't work out, it's not the right fit. How have you seen this play out, either in your own career or other coaches that you know?
I think a couple things. But I have a number of friends who have, whether they've been investigated, whether they've been let go from their careers, and I mean a number of close friends in my inner circle who are good people, good coaches, but things get twisted often. And sometimes it's a case of women tend to have to be in their various athletic departments. They have to fight for whether it's practice time, the same resources, salaries. And those coaches aren't always well received by their athletic directors. And then somebody may complain, they got disciplined, and so they view it as abuse. They don't like how their coach does things because it's not warm and fuzzy. And if you look at how male coaches coach, I don't think it's always warm and fuzzy. There's definitely moments that it needs to be warm and fuzzy, and there's no question your kids need to know you care about them and you're here to help them grow up. You're like their second parent. I mean, I think abuse is something that you would certainly, I'm not here to condone it. I want to certainly state that. But it's really a case of, are you just being pushed to a level that you don't like, and it doesn't feel good? Because it doesn't always feel good to have to push farther than you're used to. And I think that there's a lot of gender bias involved where women are held to a different standard than the men, because you don't see nearly the cases of abuse against male coaches. But a lot of those things get twisted around, and you've seen a lot of women go through allegations of abuse, when in reality, they're just coaching, and they're coaching exactly like their male counterparts. They're just viewed differently. They're held to different standards. And sometimes it's as simple as the AD doesn't like that they're questioning their practices, because there's so many cases where Title IX has improved things so much, but there's still a lot of cases where things are not equal.
What happens to women coaches who lose their jobs?
When a woman coach is fired, I have seen very, very few women resurface in the coaching profession. Not never, but at an alarming rate. I've seen a Hall of Fame softball coach who had over 900 career wins who lost her job and couldn't even get a job interview elsewhere. It's really common that when a woman is fired, no AD wants to touch them. They can have fantastic reputation in the coaching circles, but ADs don't want to deal with that. But yet you can look across the landscape of male college athletics. We look at a basketball coach who was caught drinking with college co-eds at fraternity parties, and he's still in the coaching profession after he was let go. You can go on and on. Men, it's just not the right fit, or, you know, it's part of our profession, and it is part of our profession. Sometimes it's not the right fit, or things, you know, spiral down for a coach. But I can tell you that men do a really great job of championing men, and we don't do nearly the same job of championing women and recognizing that it is part of our profession, but it doesn't make you a bad coach or a bad person. It just means it didn't work out. But we don't see women get the same second chance as men.
Who showed you the way?
Well, I think all the women who came before me. I mean, I grew up in a time when, you know, my female role models were people like Margie Wright and Linda Wells, who had coached at Minnesota for many years. Of course, Gail Blevins, who ended up being my mentor. And, you know, they coached a little bit ahead of me in a time when there was very, very little support. But they were out to create an opportunity and environment for women that was equal to what the men have, which is equal opportunity and chances to compete competitively and explore that aspect of themselves where they could play on the field and be great and become really successful women. And every day they walked out there with not nearly the support that I've ended up having over my career. And they're the ones who paved the way for people like myself. And, you know, we continue to hopefully pay it forward.
Where would you like to see the goalposts these days for the program and also for the players who, you know, right now may look at their options to play pro fast pitch and not see a lot out there?
Well, there's no question. We have a pro league. It's been fledgling, to tell you the truth, over the years. What they need is they need a big-time sponsor. You know, the WNBA has made it pretty well. They've had the help of the NBA.
I understand women's soccer is looking right now as well.
Absolutely. And I always say this, you know, I've been doing this now. I'm moving into my, getting close to my fifth decade, I suppose. It's an evolution. I'm pretty sure that the first year of Michigan football, they didn't have 110,000 people at their games. And I'm pretty sure that in the first era of all these sports, I mean, we first started out, and I came into the program in, I think, year seven. We had barely had a field. We had a few of the parents that came to the games and the sports info people, and that was about it. And now we regularly sell 2,500 tickets, and we would sell many more, but we don't have any more places for people to sit. It's evolved into that, and I believe that these opportunities for women will continue to evolve. You don't go from 0 to 60. You go from 0 to 10 and 10 to 20. And if you look at the trajectory of our popularity, I think it's this trajectory and the spike is probably steeper than the men's when it comes to attendance and attendance ratings. And I was at the women's basketball game a week ago, and they hosted Michigan State. They had 11,000 people. It takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. I think we've shown that women are a very viable option on college campuses to bring in revenue, to bring in TV, and all the things that athletic directors like. But I don't think it's fair to just compare us immediately with the men and say we should be equal with them at this point in that area. We're team 43. This is the 43rd Michigan softball team. This is baseball's, I believe they're getting close to 160. They're like 158, 159. They've been in existence quite a bit longer than we have. They've had 160 years of tradition behind them.
Do your players still come to you and say, hey, coach, I'm interested in coaching myself?
Absolutely.
What do you tell them?
I tell them it's the greatest thing you can ever do. My mom always told me that I never left college. She goes, you know, you never left college. I said, why would you? Being in college is the greatest experience of your life. And getting a chance to work with young women who, it's a perfect age group to work with because you're helping mold them into, you know, women. Strong, powerful women is ultimately what we're trying to create, is recognizing that how strong you are and how much you can offer to the world. And so the chance to be that person is the is why I went into coaching, because the strong women that influenced me, I got to play for two really strong women coaches back in the day, and they impacted me for life, and it's why I chose what I chose. So I'm always excited and do what I can to help them get started, which is put their name out there to colleagues who need volunteers or need graduate assistance and try to help them land. And we have a number of young coaches and some not so young. The head coach at Harvard and the winningest coach in the Ivy League is Jenny Allard, who was one of our first All-Americans. And Kelly Kovac-Shanley is the head coach at Ohio State. Has done a fantastic job there. And even though she's at Ohio State, you know, really proud of those kids who've grown into really strong women themselves. And they're great role models and mentors for a lot of young women.
The diaspora is real. Coach Hutchins, thank you for your service and for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Carol Hutchins is head coach for the University of Michigan softball team and the winningest coach in NCAA softball history. Her recent New York Times op-ed is titled, "Where Are All the Women Coaches?" A city audit has detailed the charges against a beloved figure in Lansing City affairs. Joan Jackson Johnson is director of the city's Office of Human Relations and Community Services. She's been on paid administrative leave since January 9th. Thanks to the audit, we now know the investigation into her department concerns financial oversight over spending and contracts. Lansing City Pulse editor Burl Schwartz has covered city affairs for the better part of two decades. Burl, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
For those who may not live in Lansing, let's just start out with explaining what the name Joan Jackson Johnson means in around town.
For some people, it's preceded by Saint Joan. She has been the leader for, since I think 2006 of the city's human relations department, and has taken it upon herself to champion homeless people. And, she has had until now a sterling reputation as sort of the St. Teresa of Lansing.
And we should say her personal story has to do with the organization that she is part of as well. I mean, she serves as the executive director of One Church and One Family. She's been involved in this work for a long time.
Absolutely. And not just that. I mean, if you look at her bio, she has been on and probably continues to serve on multiple boards that do get, in many cases, get support from the city, or if not the city, from other funding sources that the city does business with.
Can you explain what Joan Jackson Johnson's role within the city is? What exactly does the Director of Human Relations and Community Services do in Lansing?
Well, she is responsible really for administering a chunk of funds. In 2018, it was $1.6 million to various agencies throughout town that help underprivileged people. That's really the main thing that department does.
Now, questions were raised earlier this winter about some city contracts, and the state attorney general's office has been investigating for several weeks now, but the nature of the inquiry was not yet public. What do we know as of today?
Well, thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, we now have the forensic audit that the city conducted after the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Department said, you know, we are seeing potential conflicts of interest here between Joan Jackson Johnson's role as head of the city department, administering these funds, some of which are federal, and the organizations such as One Church, One Family that receive the funds. So now we have a 143-page report with addenda that spells out exactly what the audit found.
How much of a shock would you say these revelations were for people in Lansing?
I think quite a shock, and particularly in the African-American community. Joan Jackson Johnson is Black, and a number of people, some of whom are pretty well known, came down to the city council 2 weeks ago to speak out about her being suspended. She was suspended with pay by the mayor.
This was before the results of the audit were made public.
Correct. We really had no information other than a brief press release from the mayor's office saying that she had been suspended with pay because of an investigation into possible conflicts of interest. Hmm.
You spoke with Virge Bernero, the former Lansing mayor who hired Johnson. Some of this, it seems like, happened under his administration. What's he been saying?
Yeah, well, the audit covers both the end of his administration and the beginning of Mayor Shores in 2018. And Mayor Bernero has been silent as far as city issues. And he really, really felt strongly that he should not particularly criticize the new mayor. So it was a surprise when he broke his silence, and he broke it over a kind of an overriding issue of whether Mayor Shore has maintained a diverse administration. Mayor Bernero hired quite a few African Americans in his 12 years as in office. And since Mayor Bernero left, five high-up African-Americans were not continued or were let go by the new mayor. And the former Mayor Bernero has made an argument that, and I quote him, "I have concerns about this mayor's commitment to diversity." Points out, what I told you about the changes at the top. Now, to be fair to Mayor Shore, yes, some of the African Americans were replaced by people who were not African Americans. I think there were five African Americans that he replaced, and in three of the five cases, they were replaced by white people. However, he contends that if you look at the overall makeup of my leadership, if you look at women, if you look at Hispanics, if you look at the LGBT community, that we have I have very diverse leadership.
Of course, Joan Jackson Johnson remains on paid administrative leave, but has Mayor Andy Shore said anything as of today about what's in the audit or what he intends to do?
He has been very circumspect, he has not championed this. He hasn't tried to make any political hay out of this situation at all. He has pretty much maintained a public silence on it.
Burl, thanks for taking some time to talk to us about this.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Burl Schwartz is publisher of the Lansing City Pulse. Life gets busy. We know it. Woohoo, do we know it. You might not always be able to catch Stateside on your radio afternoons at 3 p.m., but that doesn't mean you have to miss out on conversations with the people who are shaping our state. Subscribe to the Stateside podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or wherever you listen. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.